cliffcentral.com.
Welcome to the SME Showcase section of our Business Masterclass. I'm Richard Angus, CEO of the finance team, your part-time financial executive solution. Joining me in studio today are two guests, Colleen Lightbody, joining us from the previous segment. And our main guest for this section of the SME Showcase is Andrew Butters, CEO of Pretty Much People. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks very much, Richard.
Andrew is also the author of a book called Eating from the Same Plate, 10 Steps to Handling and Resolving Conflict. So an interesting title on that book, and we're going to ask you a little about that a little later. So, Andrew, tell us a little bit about what is Pretty Much People?
Well, Pretty Much People is essentially a human resources and employee relations consultancy that pitches its service to, at the moment, the major focus is small and medium-sized enterprises. We have some clients that are obviously fit into the larger business enterprises, but at the moment I would say that it is predominantly focused at the medium-sized enterprises.
Okay. So your typical product offering, just give us a sense of your services as a professional firm.
Well, it's they range from, if we start off with the employee relations function, it would typically be assisting with issues of discipline handling, grievance handling, disputes within the workplace, negotiations with trade unions, whether they are plant-level negotiations relating to perhaps some other substantive issue, a wage issue, or whatever the case may be, or some other issue for that particular matter. On the employee relations side as well, it would be assisting with advice to organizations that are perhaps going through the kind of situation that you've been talking about in segment one, transfers of going concerns and
transfers of people, merger, acquisition talk.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Absolutely. So it's at that sort of operational level of employee relations that we're involved in, but also from a strategic positioning perspective, helping with strategies that are going to transform organizations into a place where the work relations and relationships are at a functional level. And then from the human resources perspective, it's really across the entire human resources value chain, relating and starting perhaps with the normal way that folk enter into the organization, looking at contracts of employment, then making sure that in terms of the induction process that follows, we assist with job profiling, workplace assessments, and so on. So it is we really operate across the entire human resources and very strongly the employee relations services. I would say probably at this point in time, around 65% of our business is devoted to dealing with the employee relations issues. That's certainly the flavor of the day.
I was going to say, it sounds like this is a real area that people find challenging. And I must tell you, I recently had an experience with one of the companies that I interact with, where I'm responsible, along with the finance team, for the financial function in the business. And we needed to take a particular course of action, which unfortunately was to tell somebody at the end of their probationary period that they were not going to be retained. And I was ready to have that conversation. And unfortunately, I'm not in the same geographic location as this particular company. So I had contacted the HR resource that's on the ground in this environment, and I had said to her, I'm like to schedule time for us to have this conversation with the person in the team, and I need to give them feedback, and this is what we have to unfortunately do. And she was quite silent on the other end of this conversation with me, and she then says to me, are you telling me you're going to have this conversation with them? And I was like, absolutely. What do you mean, am I going to have the conversation? Like, who's going to have this conversation? And then she disclosed to me that in the rest of the business, no other line manager has a conversation like that around performance with any of their staff. And then something dropped, a penny dropped for me, because I'd been out to this particular business. It's a travel scenario for us. And when I was there on site, I had been asked, as one of the senior members of the team, there were two particular parties that there were performance issues. We had to go through an exit process, unfortunately, as a result of hearing type scenarios, etc., and actually do a termination. And the one of the people in the business said to me, "Oh, well, could you please do this conversation?" And I thought this was quite normal. So I went and we did the terminations, two people, performance related, nothing you can deal with, unfortunately. Now, I always say, if somebody else makes the choice to do something, that doesn't affect, you know, can't impact on my choice to have to do what I have to do as an employer.
Indeed. You're not accountable for
their choices.
Correct.
And I did what I needed to do. And I was quite surprised, because the HR person in the room who was there with me, and I assumed they were there to handle the paperwork for me, which they did do very well and very efficient. And I was quite surprised, because they seemed a little distracted, but like a little bit like almost, let's call it, out of sorts with what happened. And then later on, when I had had this conversation with this person about the guy, a person on my team, I said, "So are you telling me that when I went and did this previous two terminations with you, you didn't expect me to do that?" And they turned to me and they said, "No, because no one else does it. And in fact, we've always been the ones who have to do it. HR has to do the practitioner, the person who's helping. You have to do this exit." And I'm going, "I just don't get this." So, yeah, I'm sure you experience this in your world, that lack of accountability in the line must be absolutely frightening. And you must see it more and more in organizations.
Richard, this is one of the biggest challenges, I guess, is perhaps even a misnomer, is the fact that the moment it smacks of people, from a management perspective, it automatically is something that gets delegated to perhaps an HR officer, HR manager, HR business partner, if you will. And I think the challenge that very often exists organizationally is to encourage line folk to be able to take up that responsibility and say, it's really okay for you to have a conversation with a direct report around an issue of poor performance. In fact, you must do it. Mm. I know that in one of my clients, and you know the client very well too, is that I'm sometimes amazed, and very often I will speak to the chief operating officer and saying, "Why are you asking me to do this? It's actually a direct line responsibility." As an example, to give you a practical example, drafting a job profile. Mm. It's a simple task. The knowledge that should exist to be able to draw up that job profile resides with the line manager. There's nobody better to be able to draw that job profile. But in this instance, I'm asked to draw it up. I do the engagement. What I effectively do is what a line manager could do, is I sit down together with the line manager, I sit together with the direct report, and we hammer out what is it that you do, how should you be measured. Those two things essentially, and then I make use of some assessment techniques to be able to draft a proper competency profile. I was encouraged by your reference to the core competency fit in the merger situation. It's very important. So coming back to the job profile situation and the issue of performance, I find that there are many instances where, and you could extend it to handling of discipline as well. It's exactly the same thing. Very often managers are perhaps insecure and they lack the confidence to be able to have those conversations at a line level, and it gets delegated. And I think it's not that organizationally internal human resources consultants would want to avoid having those conversations and helping the line managers at that level. But the reality is that I think if one looks at where it's best positioned, that is best positioned, bearing in mind that the human resources department should be the department to facilitate, to enable, to empower, and all those good things that staff functions should really do.
I'm reminded we had a colleague of mine in the First Rand Group, and anybody who's listening that maybe experienced this with me will know my saying well. We had an Afrikaans person who worked with us, and he made the statement. He was in the line, and it became quite a, and it's not a correct English statement, but it made the point. He said, IRHR. and it was humorous and at the time, and it stuck with our team, but it is the point. I, as the line manager, am the HR resource.
I think he meant to say IR and HR.
No, he was very firm that he took accountability for his people. They were what I find very enlightening was the environment where he would refer to my team and I. Okay, was his when he talked, he would say my team and I. Those were the it's not those people or them. Mm. Okay, it was an inclusive conversational space, and interestingly, while IRHR was his mantra, he actually did very little in the HR space because he had to do very little because my team and I actually got it together. And I think it talks about that cultural space we were talking of in the previous segment around that acquisition and the mindset. And I think when you get that cultural fit between people to work effectively, the need to unfortunately call on pretty much people over there, Andrew, actually reduces. Because I'm not having all these workplace issues that I have to disciplinaries and I came across a terminology that has stuck with me for a long time. The principle of an honest conversation. Yeah. And I think many people don't understand what that is, but for everyone's benefit, the principle of being able to have a very direct, open, transparent, yet non-confrontational conversation about work issues and the work that has not yet happened. I always use the expression, work has not been done. Let's not get into the why has the work not been done. What is the issues? What could change that delivery? What do we need to do things differently? And I think when you start having performance conversations and expectation management around work has not been done, you get away from this emotional context that you were referring to earlier, Colleen, about people getting emotionally invested in their workspace. And I guess we all get emotionally invested in the workspace. It's natural. But I think conflict in the workspace reduces significantly when people just talk about the facts, talk about the issues, and find what the issue is and how to resolve it. And then the important thing I find, and I might be wrong here, Andrew, you can tell me, but I find people don't let bygones be bygones and move on. I find, the last year this time, that person also did this. And I'm going, okay, there might be some relevance there, but why are we, why are we collecting stamps here? Have you been happy for a year with this person's performance? So why is what happened a year ago now relevant again? Mm. They've been performing really well for 11 months, and now something else happens, and now you roll out 11 months ago history, and now it's a big issue.
Yeah, let me start off. You raised three very important issues here, and they three sort of different thoughts. The first is, let's start off with the conflict. During the week, I had to preside over a grievance hearing. Believe it or not, and you can go tut, I did much the same. The grievance was effectively tabled around the fact that a particular direct report was going through a performance appraisal process, which is a normal process, and the line, thankfully, we're handling it. And essentially what happened is there was an old and new manager. The old manager, no disrespect to him, was retiring, and the new manager was taking over. So the grievance effectively was around the fact that the new manager was making comments and observations during the performance appraisal process which had no place within that conversation. I'm saying, really? Is it not the right of anybody who's taking over to gather context, or for that matter to try to understand what has gone on before? So in introducing, which is your point around the history, I think it is a case of we really do have to work hard to forgive and forget. We've got to get to that place where we are able to do so. And in introducing the purpose of this grievance hearing and how it would run and what have you, and I covered a lot of the principles that that I've dealt with in the book, I essentially said, look, it's not going to help us to focus on the history, because the history is not a fair indicator, and it's going to bind us from being able to come out with a solution. So from that perspective, I think you're absolutely right in dealing with conflict. If you hold on to the past, and I think our own country is a classic example of the fact that there is a rather unhappy and sordid past, the reality is if we choose to hold on to that, as we do organizationally, as we do, and I think Colleen would tell you about the neurologically, the impact that that has on the human body. If we choose to do that, it's going to be a life sentence.
Colleen, thoughts there? In terms of just how people handle conflict. I mean, what happened? I mean, you've talked earlier about some of the let's call it the emotional states that one finds oneself in. I mean, when it gets into that conflict state, what is the mind actually doing at that point? Share that.
The mind is in survival mode, because as soon as there's a conflict, that other person becomes the threat.
Okay.
And people are experienced as a threat to your life, so therefore you will go into fight or flight
or
defend, you know. So that's what you're
not
dealing.
That I want to defend, but
yes, exactly.
How many times? Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that that must be the most used phrase in the employee handbook.
Yes, but.
Now, Andrew, you've written this book, Eating from the Same Plate: 10 Steps to Handling and Resolving Conflict. Tell us a little bit about that book and what have you learned from that experience of writing.
The act of writing the book was really a situation in which what kind of triggered it initially was the fact that part of the service base that perhaps I ought to have mentioned that we don't that I didn't at the time when you asked about pretty much people is we also run training programs and what have you, and I had thought that there was a need to kind of do an ancillary document, handout, manual, if you like, to a training course that I was running at that particular point in time. And as I got into writing that, I suddenly thought to myself, but hang on a second, there was a fairly recent example that of a situation that was just so relevant. And I started to anecdotally put this story together. And as I did, I began to think, but hang on a second, you know, let's just advance that a little bit more. So my wife says that the book is not quite her kind of read. It's very manual driven, and it's very driven towards the, you know, it's been instructive, teaching orientated. But on the other hand, I've had some very good feedback around it in terms of saying, well, you know, it's so practical, it's how to, which is very much like I am. And the experience was a great experience in writing the book. It helped me to kind of crystallize thoughts and to put them down around the topic of conflict. And it helped me a lot in terms of putting me into a position, perhaps where I I took a look at the people that I assist, typically my clients, and I thought, how can I simplify this thing of conflict? How can I get them to think differently about conflict? I'm very often said to be very comfortable with conflict. And I said, yes, I am, because I deal with it every day.
I was going to say, your life is conflict, Andrew, given the nature of what you do. You work with employer and employee, and that is often why they're talking to you. So yeah.
Absolutely. And so in terms of the book, I typically start off and talk a little bit about the theory of conflict and you know, try to unravel that a little bit, different types of conflict. And then what I do is very practically deal with the kinds of typical steps, phases in the conflict process, and the things that I find have been very effective for me in being able to resolve those conflicts, using the story of Sally, a sales rep who was an incredibly awkward and difficult person to deal with, and all the different stakeholders that were part of that very messy conflict.
So let me guess, there's a little anecdote on the front of the book, if I remember, that says all names and places have been changed to protect the not so innocent.
Indeed. Absolutely.
Now, Andrew, just for listeners, where could they get a copy of this book should they wish to participate and read about what you're talking about?
Thanks very much, Richard. I think there are various options. They can either go to our website, www.prettymuchpeople.co.za, and it is available online. They can purchase a copy through the website. It is available on Amazon if you search on the title of the book as well.
So the title is Eating from the Same Plate. -10 steps to handling and resolving conflict.
Indeed. So if
by
you would
Andrew
just
Butters.
If you just go to www.amazon.com, search on the book title, and you can find it. Otherwise, if you follow on Twitter at Andrew Butters SA or @P_MuchPeople, the book is available and will lead you to a direct link to making a purchase.
Okay, great. Now, Andrew, just from your growth as an entrepreneur, I mean, you've established Pretty Much People. You've worked with people who've worked through acquisitions in their business. And earlier we spoke about the psychology of acquisitions. Just share with us for a moment, you know, the type of things that you've seen out there where acquisitions have worked and perhaps where they haven't.
Absolutely. And there have been a lot of examples of both. Where it's worked, I think it has been because of a good understanding of the cultures. Years ago, it goes back to when I was still a young HR practitioner in a large corporate. We went through in the cable industry a transaction between an organization whose culture very typically was German-based, and the culture of the organization that we were blending with or merging with was very typically British-based. And
I can see this already.
So that was at a higher level, organizational level. But then you end up in a situation where practically and operationally it was an Afrikaans culture predominantly with a strict British culture. So the company that we would that we were involved with would typically want to start meetings with cucumber sandwiches and tea and have a frank conversation, whereas the organization that I was used to was just we have an agenda, let's hit the agenda and get the meeting done as quickly as possible. That particular transaction didn't go particularly well because the cultures just organizationally and didn't blend very well.
And Kundin, help me here. I mean, I'm looking at you and going, this just sounds like a recipe for disaster from what you described. And culturally, so once again, the hard, soft stuff that just
in group out group behavior.
Yeah. Oh, dynamics. Yeah. Oosh.
There's another recent example within the IT industry, again, where it's worked incredibly well. Mm. And it's worked incredibly well because the two parties have, they did all the homework up front. They talked about what were the expectations around the acquisition. All the homework was done in terms of the due diligence. By due diligence, I'm talking about the terms and conditions of staff. I'm talking about the leave accruals, which entity is going to pay over the leave, if any is going to be paid over, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. That was done very thoroughly. And in the new entity, the culture has just been a very, very easy fit, built centrally around the people of that particular organization. So it's been an easy merge for that to happen. I think the preparation is an important part for it to work well. I think honesty and openness is an important part of the process. And I think, culturally, there are different ways of doing things, and I think if those cultures are very, very diverse, I think it is going to be a case of never the two will meet, and there will be an unhappy situation between those particular cultures, whether it's a culture linguistic, whether it is a culture ethnicity, based in ethnicity. It doesn't matter. The principle is this, that there are different ways of doing things. It could be at an organizational cultural level where you have a typically autocratic organization, and the organization that has been merged is perhaps somewhat more democratic and participative. That's also not going to work. So I think from a perspective, perhaps I've addressed both of those issues together, but I think the instances that I've seen where acquisitions have not worked well has been typically because the proper homework has not been done. I think Section 197 of the Labor Relations Act is a very, very onerous portion of the legislation because for all intents and purposes, the new employer simply replaces the old employer in all respects, and the employee must be left in a situation where, on the whole, they're no worse off after the merge than they were before.
And I think that, for me, is just something so key in the whole question of an acquisition, is that you've got to really know and understand your legal position relative to your employment environment as an acquirer. You're basically assuming the role of the employer of the group that you're acquiring. So that's a critical part of what you do.
Absolutely. And the other thing as well is that just in terms of some of the other things, very, very briefly, is I think in one of the questions that you were raising with Colleen is an issue around what would she, as an example, look at for purposes of acquisition, if she was being acquired or acquiring. I think quite a centrally important part of it is around branding and so on. Whose brand is going to prevail? Whose culture is going to prevail? Mm. So I think it's probably the crucial things that can make your acquisition deal either work or not work.
Work or not work. Well, we're out of time. Just that email, that website again, www.prettymuchpeople.co.za, if you wish to interact with Andrew. Andrew, thank you very much for joining us on the show. Colleen, thank you for being with us. We really do appreciate the time today.
Thanks, Richard.
Next up, our youth leadership platform. CliffCentral.com.